are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
It's Sunday. That means you are listening to the main course. We are broadcasting out of Roberta's Restaurant, 261 Moore Street. Take the L train to Morgan Avenue in New York City, in Brooklyn. And the main course, I think we're on episode 206 or something. So that's over 4 years that we've been broadcasting the best of food news. So thank you so much for listening. Today, we have a really great guest. The journalist Marion Burroughs is going to be on with us in a second. She is a New York Times columnist. She worked with the Washington Post. She was the food critic there. She's written 9 books. She also covered a few state dinners that we will talk about. We'll hear about Hillary Clinton and the Bush clan and how their first state dinners went. I'm predicting hot dogs and hamburgers for the Bushes, but I'm probably wrong. We're going to get the real lowdown on what people ate at those very important dinners. In other news, the Heritage Radio Network just came out with a press release, and it is very exciting. You know, as everyone knows, in 2013, along with 35 entertaining and informative weekly food-focused programs, HRN launched a news division with a team of writers who produce stories in the categories of health, pleasure, science, and tech, news, opinion, and business. And now in 2014, in addition to these categories, the staff will focus on 3 areas of concern to us. And Aaron Fairbanks, the executive director of HRN, has picked the chicken industry, food waste, and the future of food leadership. And those are really exciting categories. I am really supportive of those 3 issues. As people know or might know, 2013, chicken surpassed beef as the most consumed protein in America, and as such are the livestock most impacted by the factory farming system. So it'll be interesting to see the stories that come out of that issue over the next year. And regarding food waste, you know, from field to fork, over 40% of food produced for consumption in the U.S. is wasted at some point along the production chain. So that'll be another interesting field of study. And you can find the food waste stories. They are delineated by an FW. So anything with an FW covers that issue. And then, you know, this is very exciting. I could have used this when I was starting with slow food. They have a 3rd category, the future of food leadership, and they are seeking revolutionaries in the food world. So if you have someone to nominate for the Future of Food Leadership Awards, definitely contact the Heritage Radio Network. As people know, Heritage Radio Network is a grassroots, action-oriented, nonprofit, internet-based radio station focused on creating a food world that is more sustainable, equitable, and delicious. So give your nonprofit donation and get a free tote bag and log on to our website and continue checking out our new shows and our new news stories. But talking about today, we are very honored to have a great writer, Marion Burroughs, on the show with us. Marion, are you with us?
I'm here.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being on.
My pleasure.
Yeah, where are we calling? We're calling Washington, D.C. That's where you're based most of the time, correct?
That's where I am. Mm-hmm.
So you started out as a food columnist and reporter for the New York Times, a position you held starting in 1981. So it's a big thing to be a columnist for the New York Times, and I know a lot of your stories were covered even in the A section of the paper, not just in the food section. So I have to ask you, what trends and changes did you see over that time? Which ones did you predict, and which ones surprised you?
I'm not sure I predicted any, but I'm not sure any of them surprised me either way. The only thing I can really think of that I thought was something going really going in the right direction that I predicted would be oatmeal. stone ground oats rather than flat rolled. So that now today, back when I thought about this 20 years ago, it was hard to find anything but the rolled oats in the regular grocery store. And now you can find two and three varieties just in the regular grocery store of the stone ground rather than the rolled, or mm-hmm. both. And in some of the more, specialty type markets, you can find five and six kinds of stone ground oatmeal. And by the way, it tastes a whole lot better.
Now, there must have been a lot of changes in the supermarket. I mean, when you started writing for the Times in 1981, I mean, there weren't even that many great cheeses or olive oils or tomatoes in the markets yet.
Right. Well, to tell you the truth, I started writing about food back in 1964, I think. Anyway, somewhere back in the 60s, in the dark ages. So I spent some time yesterday and today looking as much as I could at things that I had written about in the past, and what surprised me most goes back even further than at the Times, and that is what babes in the woods we were in the 60s. We were absolutely babes in the woods. Anything that anybody told you about food from the government or to a food company, that was what we believed. And as time went on, we got less and less certain that they knew what they were talking about, and the consumer movement really came into its own in the 1970s. I mean, I you wouldn't believe, and people who weren't born there or were very small would be surprised to find out what we didn't do. They might probably are not surprised to find out a lot of things have never gotten fixed, because back in that time, the Federal Trade Commission proposed regulating food advertising to children. I think we're still there working on that one.
Yeah, for sure.
But they also were discussing food additives and whether they were safe or not. And they just began to set tolerance levels for things like mercury and lead and aflatoxin in food, and they'd never done that before. And the school lunch program, which is now being discussed again and again because there are new rules they're talking about for it. At that time, it was in such disrepute back in the 70s that children were leaving it at the rate of 500,000 a year. And things like brown rice and bulgur and whole wheat bread were just beginning to come along. It was amazing. A lot of this had to do with the spotlight from 1977, the spotlight on the report from the Senate Nutrition Committee, which was chaired by George McGovern. And they wrote dietary guidelines. They called it Dietary Goals for the United States. And that was sort of the beginning of people taking an even closer look at what we are eating and why we're eating it. I have one line in one story that I still can't get over because I wrote, "Sugar continues to decline."
Wow.
We know this isn't true.
Yeah.
So that's when a lot of this stuff started, and by the 80s, when I was at the New York Times, there was a whole new food world out there, still with plenty of problems, but at least we had all kinds of things available that we had never had before. We started in the early 80s. I wrote about something called In Defense of Vegetarianism. This is what it's 20, a little over 20 years ago we're talking now. No, it's 20 or 30 years ago now. And people that were, actually, I wrote about seven vegetarians who were well known at one time. The other thing that surprised me when I look back was that in 1986, it was possible to write that small farms find prosperity. And I didn't think it went back that far, the small farmer and sustainability. And all the things that we think of are very important today. Those are the years that I was writing about. Particularly, I discovered I wrote more about fish than almost anything else. mostly about things that were in fish that you really shouldn't be eating, like mercury. And the various kinds of arguments from the industry and what the government was trying to do and what advocates really thought was right about it. I don't think they've still really come to a very good decision about all of that in terms of how much mercury is safe in your diet. I mean, I think the answer is that there's really no amount that's safe in your diet. And but they're still arguing about it. And the things that always amazed me were the things like some group calling itself the Maternal Nutrition Group was saying you should be eating more fish rather than less fish. And after I dug a while, I discovered that actually the National Fisheries Institute was promoting the organization and its campaign. And the U.S. Tuna Foundation had joined in with the National Fisheries Institute a public relations group had, in order to promote more fish of every kind, and that definitely meant tuna, because I don't think there's anything we eat more of than tuna because of all the canned tuna that's around.
Sure. Now, were there any things that you wrote about back then, just totally ignorant of what you would find out later in life as a journalist, and you're like, I can't believe I recommended that I told people to eat old tuna or you know, things like that?
No.
You always did the
really.
Research.
No, it's not that I was so smart. It's just that those years earlier, from the 60s when I started writing by the time I got to the New York Times, I had become a very jaded reporter who believed very little of what I heard until I could find it proven somewhere. And there's always the fear, you know, you're going to make a mistake in the New York Times. New York Times isn't going to be very happy about it, and not that I didn't make them, because if you go back and look, you'll find there were corrections. And the public is going to have a bad impression of the New York Times. So you were very, very, very careful about making mistakes like that and changing your mind. And I have to tell you, since the 60s, the things that I decided to stop eating, I still don't eat. And the things that I thought were not good for you, I still don't eat, or I eat very little of them. So no, I haven't. If anything, I've become more more jaded, because I think the situation in terms of this is what happened in the 70s, you saw it start to happen. The consumer advocacy groups were taken on by the food industry through lobbying, and that's gotten much, much worse. Or let's not use the word worse. Let's just say it's become much heavier, and the lobbies are more powerful than they ever were before. And the result is that people who have groups that think that there are things that the food industry should not be doing or things that the government should be doing, they find very, very hard to turn things around now.
So have the corporations gotten more vicious and worse and more calculated, or were they kind of always starting in the 50s and 60s, already starting to spin bad things that they were doing? Or, I mean, was there a turning point or a tipping point where corporations became evil, or are they not evil?
Don't use that word. Let's just say that the bottom line is what's the most important thing to them. Mm-hmm. And if that means that they've got to convince you that, you know, sugary soft drinks are good for you, they'll go at it. The only way that the consumer, the ordinary person, has any luck with any of this is if there becomes such a big swell of people. So that today you can now see Coca-Cola. There are stories that say that Coca-Cola has to rethink what else it's going to sell, because people are drinking fewer soft drinks. They can't put them in the schools anymore for the most part. Mm-hmm. So that they have to find other ways to make their money, because a lot of things, they go overseas to make a lot of it. Because they can't sell it the way they used to sell it. And that's true with many, many things.
Well, interesting. Yeah, things have changed a little bit. So now, one of the big issues, and you've kind of touched upon it a little bit already, so, your coverage of food safety issues in the New York Times was a big focus for you. What did you hope to accomplish with that? And I know you're based in Washington in large part because that's where a lot of these lobbying things happen, or a lot of the law work, obviously, with all this happens. So, and a lot of these food issues that you wrote about were upgraded. I mean, you came from the food section and graduated to the A section, the front page of the New York Times a lot of the time, because of how important these issues were. So could you speak a little bit about that aspect of your life's work and what you accomplished and what stories you covered?
Well, I don't know that what I accomplished so much. I tried to make people aware, and then they had to, you know, you make people aware and they're going to make a choice. And I'll tell you, for example, that the things like wild salmon, whether you want to eat wild salmon or farmed salmon, I think it's not quite the same problem it was at one time that fact that farmed salmon, most of the farming of salmon still pollutes waters and allows farmed salmon to get in with the wild salmon, which is not good for the wild salmon, and produces disease because there are wild salmon swimming where farmed salmon are also located. Some of these things have been made better than they were, but I never eat farmed salmon, and many people do, and they eat a lot of it. And it's what they use, what they fed the salmon that makes the color that you see in wild salmon, which is not what you get in farmed salmon, where they put things in their diet to make them the right color, because what the farmed salmon eat would make them sort of pale, pale pink or pale, pale orange, whatever color you want to call that. That's the real color of farmed salmon. I still think that wild salmon, but it's very expensive. I think wild salmon is better for you because of the nutrients that it has in it that farmed salmon cannot have because they don't eat the same way. However, there's probably nothing as seriously wrong with eating farmed salmon as there was at one time, because I believe that a number of changes have been made. You just have to say I was really wrong on that in a way. Because it's good that people are eating fish, and people love salmon. Of course, the reason they love the farmed salmon is because it doesn't have very much taste. Wild salmon has more of a taste, and I've had people tell me they don't like the taste of wild salmon.
Well, here's a quote from a critic of yours. You know, we were joking about this the other day, but Burroughs and her ilk have spent the last 40 years publicly denigrating perfectly safe pesticides, fertilizers, and other chemicals as dangerous, yet there is no evidence that any legally applied pesticide has ever harmed anyone. So that's part of the food safety issues. Can you respond to that?
Yeah, That shows an enormous amount of ignorance. But I'm used to that, believe me. Whoever this was is just one of many. The thing that you can never tell when people eat very small quantities of any of these pesticides that put them into their system, there's no way we're ever going to know which ones were hazardous. In the end, to that particular person, we do know that some of these pesticides and things cause cancer in laboratory animals. And there isn't a whole lot of reason to believe that they wouldn't eventually do the same thing in humans if they got enough of them in them. We don't believe in the precautionary principle in this country, and most European countries do. And that means if there's a possibility that this might not turn out to be a good idea, let's not do it. We go with the good old American frontier spirit. Oh, you know, full steam ahead. We'll worry about it later. And so people who make the criticism that we're trying to prove that that we're warning people about things that have a lot of pesticides in them, it just so shows ignorance more than anything else. It's like assuming that everything's going to be just fine with the taking the oil, the crude oil from Canada and running it under our near our waterways and things, and nothing's going to happen because we need it. Well, maybe you should think about it a little longer before you make that kind of decision. Mm-hmm. So, I you know, go ahead and criticize that. I mean, I've been called worse actually than that.
And does your precautionary principle apply to the GMO issue as well?
Of course.
Mm-hmm. I mean, is it so? It is bad until you can prove that it's safe. Is the correct way we should all be looking at it?
I'm not going to say it's bad. I'm going to say it's an unknown. And you know, if you go see something, a mushroom, you go out in the forest and you're picking wild mushrooms, and you're not sure what that mushroom is. You don't recognize it. But what the hell? Why not? The other mushrooms were okay. Well, it turned out that was the wild one that killed you. Mm-hmm. GMOs have to do with somebody wanting to make a lot of money and making a lot of money and making it extremely difficult for people who have regular crops they are raising to raise them without getting them contaminated. It's all about money. It isn't about that we need all of these things because we're going to starve to death. It's just not true.
Well, I understand that with Monsanto, for sure. You know, yes, they are in the profit game, and they are trying to make themselves indispensable to farmers everywhere, especially in the third world. But how would you respond to someone like Bill Gates, who, you know, is dedicating millions and millions of his dollars to, you know, stop the tide of starvation in places like Africa by investing in GMO foods? I mean, that kind of blurs the issue a little bit, no?
That yeah, it sure does, but that doesn't mean we have to grow these crops in this country. Of course it blurs the issue, but you're going to kill off a whole bunch of people and destroy all the regular crops we have in this country? Or is it do we have to make a choice between feeding people who are... We're starving, which is very unfortunate, and killing off a whole bunch of other people. The thing about something like the GMOs is that we've discovered that in the end, it's already been shown with some crops, that the whole business with the pesticides is that then even the crops that have been, for which you don't no longer have to use pesticides, now you have to use pesticides in them mm-hmm. because they have... The GMOs have not helped to make them strong and weed resistant. So it's not as if we can go around Mother Nature and win. Eventually we lose there too. And then what?
Right. Well, for sure. And what about, you must have been at the crossroads of the HACCP plan wars. I mean, there was a lot of resistance to mm-hmm. hazard analysis and critical control points and all of the work that was going to be bringing. And it did shut down a lot of businesses. Was that part of all?
They should have been shut down.
They should have been shut down. Talk about the evolution of HACCP and what that's meant to the food world.
Well, I mean, there's still problems with fish. There's no question. I can't say there are more problems with fish than anything else. I don't know that. Because every time you turn around, they need to close some other place that's making ground beef. And then chickens have, you know, other problems. The HACCP system has worked much better than anything we had before. It's not perfect, but it has made fish safer to eat. And fish is very, very good for you. It doesn't have all that fat that the meat has in it, and it has nutrients in it that meat and poultry do not have. So it's a very good thing if fish is safer to eat. The problem is with fish that we are overfishing some places, and we have fewer and fewer fish all the time that we can eat.
Well, for sure. And tell me about antibiotics in the food supply. Is that also precautionary? I mean, people are saying, oh, well, the antibiotics.
No. We know that what happens with that. We already know, and we've known that for years.
So why isn't something done about it? I mean, that's just the strength of the lobby.
Yeah.
What is the political of that lobby?
There's a very short answer to that. This has been going on. I remember this quite specifically when... David Kessler was the commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration. And they tried every which way, and they get it out of some food, and then it gets into other, and then it's used illegally to keep the animals. You know, if they did the right things by the animals to begin with and didn't crowd them in all together so that they easily infect one another and put them in a situation where they are not as naturally... strong as they would be otherwise, then of course you're going to have the problems. That's mostly what antibiotics are put into food supply for, to keep them healthy. They're not allowed to do it in certain, just for the hell of it anymore. There are certain regulations, but they're not so strong yet. And the result is that there are fewer and fewer antibiotics that are working on humans.
So how does this lobby work? I mean, this is a stupid question for sure, but how in good conscience?
Well, I won't give you an answer.
Well, how do senators and House of Representatives in good conscience, do they deny the science or do they just say that this is a price of doing business, that you just have to live with these realities? I mean, how can you lobby for things that are obviously proven to be bad? I mean, where does that happen? It happens over dinner tables in Washington, D.C. I mean, I don't know. I mean, do people...
Sure.
I mean, yeah.
Well, not so much dinner tables anymore because supposedly you can't lobby. You know, you can't pay for senator's meal or congressman's meal or whatever. Or it can't cost more than $25. I can't remember which one is that now. But... yes, of course. This is some guy, the farmer people that want those antibiotics, the antibiotic companies, they're in your district, and you have to be nice to them. Otherwise, they're not going to vote for you, or they're not going to give you any money for your reelection. That's how these things happen.
And that's why they want the certain parties to fight against capping how much an election can cost, right, or how much you can donate, because they rely on having more money from companies like this to be able to beat out. Aren't we going to get to a day where a presidential candidate or a senator with $1 billion won't mean as much anymore in terms of power because of Twitter and Facebook and all of that? Or, I mean, money is still going to win you Senate seats?
I cannot predict the future, but based on the fact that more and more money is being poured in to campaigns than ever before by richer and richer people, I don't know. This certainly, if things were to change, I'll be long dead.
Well, then let's talk about something a little bit more exciting than this, because this really does really tick a guy
off. Well, maybe the word is a little less depressing.
A little less depressing. Well, I don't know. It depends. You're going to answer whether it's depressing, because you're going to talk a little bit about the first state dinners, and we're going to just talk about the state dinners for Bush, Clinton, and then Bush. The newer Bush, the younger Bush, the younger, but also there are other presidents that you might have a little something to say about, not in the context of the state dinner, but just having somewhat of an understanding of what they ate and what they thought about food. So talk about, I know first state dinners are, you know, honors a head of state, like a king, a prime minister, or a president, and you've gone to many of them, but take us through, maybe let's start with Hillary Clinton's and Bill Clinton's first state dinner, and what you covered, what you saw, what they ate, and what you thought about it.
Well, that doesn't mean I went to the state dinners. I just mm-hmm. covered them.
Right.
It's a different story. And I covered them from behind the scenes. I was permitted from, I would say, probably the Johnson administration, but certainly whoever followed Johnson. Carter?
No. Nixon.
Is that right?
Yes. Well, Nixon. Nixon.
I'm sorry.
Ford, Carter, yeah.
For starting with the Nixon administration for sure, but it may have been the Johnson administration. I just cannot look at those files. I cannot find those files to tell you. I covered state dinners from the kitchen. I was allowed to come beforehand and talk to the chefs and look at what they were cooking and talk to the person who arranged the flowers and the person who picked the china. And generally, I was also given access to the first lady and talked to her about, you know, what her ideas were. And the joke always with the Nixons was that the American wines were served. He was the first president to insist on, or somebody insisted, that American wines be served. However, Nixon himself was served French wine.
That's funny.
So, things and the state dinners were pretty much after Jacqueline Kennedy changed from the square tables and long table to the round tables. Pretty much everything stayed more or less the same, and most of the food was sort of French based, and it was all that very formal surface of the service where they bring the platter around and you awkwardly put the food on your plate, because it is really awkward. Until Hillary Clinton, things changed a lot. First of all, they had the first American chef who stayed any length of time, came in during the Clinton administration. They actually dismissed the French chef because he was unwilling or unable, we don't know, to cook the kind of food that the Clintons wanted to eat, which was, I guess you would call it, light and contemporary. So they chose Walter Scheib. And there were no French sauces, or the saddles of veal, or fish mousse and aspic, or truffle sauces, or any of those things. First state dinner Scheib cooked was, he described the entree as a hybrid American. Grilled Arctic char and lobster sausage with wild mushroom risotto. Braised fennel, vegetable ragu, and a roasted garlic and lime sauce. Then there were field greens with goat cheese and basil baked in a phyllo with a port wine dressing. And most of the cream and the butter was gone, maybe a little bit for the vegetables, he said. And they drank American wine, California wine and an Oregon wine. Mm-hmm. And then for dessert, I wonder if I have this here. The pastry chef at that time and until, oh gosh, maybe 10 years ago now, was a fellow called Roland Mesnier, very French.
I have his book,
he was brilliant.
Yeah.
The calories did not count, and it could be the most complicated thing in the world that you wanted to have. The dessert for that meal was cherry sherbet with almond ice cream in spun sugared cherry topped with a spun sugared cherry blossom. And that was because it was in honor of the Emperor of Japan. And so they wanted, and they had lots of cherry blossoms around, et cetera, et cetera. They wanted it to, that the pastry chef always did something that was a theme for the country that was being honored. He did one dinner for the Queen of England. I think it was the Queen of England. It may have been a not really a state dinner. It may have been a... No, I think maybe it was the Queen. Well, I'm sorry. I'm not going to worry about that. He did what do they call that clock in London?
Big Ben?
Big Ben. He did a dessert that had Big Ben in it in honor of whoever it was that was being honored from England.
Now, did the chefs also have to follow protocol and somewhat stay true to, depending on who the head of state was, or the chef had more freedom and it was more the dessert chef that had to, pastry chef that had to, you know, pay homage to the culture where the head of state was from?
No. He always did. It was just because what he wanted to do. The first ladies have always had their hand in all of these menus, some much more so than others. And one of them started the precedent of having the experimental dinner. They put all the things together. The first lady had it for lunch. Maybe she had it with somebody. Maybe she didn't. And she would say what she thought about it and what she wanted change. Mm-hmm. And that has gone on through, went back to Nancy Reagan and has gone on through that. And I don't know about the Obamas because they do not let a lot of press into much of anything. And even all I've done this particular story since at least Nixon, I've never been able to get access to behind the scenes for a state dinner, so I really can't tell you. What the Obamas do is bring in at various times guest chefs who cook for state dinners and other occasions with the staff that is already there. The White House does have a chef, Chris Comerford, and these people come in and work with her as well.
Was there one president or first lady that was particularly concerned with the origins of where the food came from or how things tasted? Or, I mean, they were all kind of, I mean, was was one, would you say the palate of one of the presidential couples was better than the others? Or, I mean, was it always just solid and no one ever knew where the food came from?
Well, first of all, I'm not going to go and discuss with you or anybody else tonight, because I don't know the answer, which one had the best palate.
Mm-hmm.
But they all cared. I'll tell you who didn't care one way or another. She had such faith in the staff, and that was Barbara Bush. Whatever they wanted to do was fine with her, because she thought that they did such a good job. Nancy Reagan was much more interested and involved, and so was Hillary Clinton. They were very, very involved. Where the food comes from has changed over the years. It is, however, they weren't so careful about it as they are now, but it's food. You're never going to know where the food came from for obvious reasons.
Sure.
And now they try to get it locally as much as they can, but not necessarily. And they try to make it sustainable. A small amount may come from the White House garden, but the White House garden doesn't have enough to feed a big state dinner, much of anything except maybe some greens. And but everything else is a secret for safety reasons.
Hmm.
And the chefs will present a menu, but they will not. But you know, they're at the beck and call of the first lady, and the Mrs. Bush, the second Mrs. Bush, Laura Bush, decided that she didn't think that she wanted other things besides what Walter Scheib was cooking. And so she started bringing in things like, or at least her social secretary, name escapes me at the moment, started presenting the chef with magazines and pictures of dishes in magazines that they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, there's nothing more insulting to a chef than being shown a woman's magazine with pictures of the food in it. There were some cookbooks that may have been presented or what as well. At any rate, they seemed to have come to a parting of ways, and they announced that Walter Scheib was resigning from the White House. However, Walter Scheib wasn't going to let that pass. And if I can find it quickly enough to get it for you so I can tell it to you, I did pull up the story about Scheib's dismissal. My story started off like this. Unlike members of the White House staff who maintained the fiction that resigning was their decision, the executive chef, Walter Scheib III, minced no words Friday in saying he had been fired. "We've been trying to find a way to satisfy the First Lady's stylistic requirements," Mr. Scheib said in a telephone interview, "and it has been difficult. Basically, I was not successful in my attempt.
Oh, brother.
So, Walter has gone on to quite marvelous things. He's, I don't know whether he's still doing this, but for all the years after he left, for quite a long time, he was going out and for a quite large fee for various groups of people who were wanted to entertain sometimes their clients or sometimes they wanted to give their company a big party. He would go and do a White House menu for a dinner and then talk about cooking at the White House.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to one of them when it was done in New York on a ship that was in New York Harbor. Oh, I guess the ship was docked in Brooklyn, wherever. And they all came aboard to a dinner in the ship's dining room, and Walter did this fabulous dinner that was based on something he'd done at the White House, and people were just eating it up. So don't feel sorry for him. It was a wonderful experience.
He did okay for himself?
He's done okay for himself.
That's good. What is the salary of a White House chef? I mean, do you know that, or are you at liberty to say? I mean, are
no,
they
it's
paid?
Not that I'm not at liberty to say. I just don't know what it is today.
Mm-hmm.
I know it a lot. Whatever it is, it's nowhere near what as is any government job. Nowhere near what he could get in the private sector for doing, doing meals for such important people, or being the chef at some incredible restaurant like Per Se or something. So they do it maybe when they start off like Walter, they do it because they didn't have a job that was that exciting to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. He came from, where did he come from? Well, I'm not going to, again, I'm not going to hold you up. He came from, maybe he came from west of the, that resort in West Virginia. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. And that may, you know, that's great, and you can make a good salary, but it's not a place that's known for the most exquisite cooking in the world. It's nice cooking. And that's perfect. The White House is, you're serving 120 people, 110 people at a state dinner, and much larger groups for other things. So this, you're not going to get the food you're going to get in the best restaurant in town. It's not meant to be.
Now, do most of these, most presidents eat at the White House most of the time? I mean, it is essentially like going out, right? Because they can pick whatever they want. And, I mean, are there presidents that are, you know, working it politically? I just saw the play, Broadway play, LBJ. I mean, he was always politicking. I mean, are there some presidents that ate out all the time?
No. Oh, no.
No.
I mean, if they had lots of evening meals, they might do that. But no. And in fact, this particular president has made it a rule when he didn't have to go out to eat with his family every night, and has done a relatively good job of it. Of course, now he's out doing a lot of politicking for his budget and for basically the future. So he's not home as often as ordinarily. But, oh, no, all their meals are taken at home except when they themselves feel like going out to dinner. Now, the biggest goer-outer to dinner of all is Michelle Obama. And
you know that
firsthand.
Generally
with the president, but she does dinners with her friends. She does lunches. She loves to eat, and she loves to try new things.
Well, I know that you're an expert on this particular issue, because did you not visit about 25 of the restaurants that Michelle went to? And I loved reading this piece in Politico, and you talk about how essentially, you know, people always insulted her and hurled, insults at her on the anti-Obama blogs about what she would eat and, you know, a 1,700 calorie meal. And yet she's fighting for, you know, people eating sustainably in school. So you went out firsthand and went restaurant to restaurant to find out what exactly she ate. And my favorite part of this is a lot of those restaurants would be like, we refuse to tell you what Michelle ate. So you would go to the restaurant and you would, when the waiter would come to your table, you would be like, well, I just want what Michelle ate. And of course, they would be so happy to give you the exact meal. So you did your research in various ways, but what did you find? What conclusions did you draw?
First of all, that 1,700 calorie meal, supposedly, did anybody ever bother to ask whether she was buying something for somebody else to eat as well?
Great point.
No, they never. If they did, they neglected to tell us. And if she ate a 1,700 calorie meal and looks as good as she looks, more power to her.
Yeah, great job.
She does a lot of exercise, and she does a lot of working out. And she looks great. Anyway, and by the way, they are not always on anti-Obama logs. They sometimes are responding to a story that you do to which they are, you know, given permission to make a comment.
Sure.
And lots of anti-Obama things appear on those places, too. Mm-hmm. But that's neither here nor there. In most places, I didn't have any trouble. But as you say, some places didn't want to tell me, and so we sort of pretended we were little country folk from out of town. And we'd love to have just what Mrs. Obama had. And as you say, it always worked. Sometimes I even sent somebody to go back into the kitchen to find out.
That's funny.
Service that. Excuse me. I'll tell you what she loves. She loves steak.
Hmm.
And you will see that on the menu at different White House functions, because she really does love steak. But she also loves vegetables. I mean, she likes good food. She just eats it in moderation. There's nothing that you shouldn't eat unless it's going to poison you. You just have to eat the right amount of it. And you can look like Michelle Obama, too. So other than steak and a lot of vegetables, I can't pick out any one particular thing that she ate to the exclusion of any other. I think she tried a lot of different things from all kinds of places. She loves ethnic food. And she loves, you know, American food as well.
Did she go to the great restaurants? I mean, are there great restaurants that for some reason she hasn't been to? I mean, is she hitting all the good places in D.C., but also when she goes elsewhere?
I can't tell you about elsewhere, except I can sort of tell you about Hawaii because I go there, you know, for a winter during Christmas. And she certainly hit the right restaurants in Hawaii because I know some of them. I don't know so much where she's eaten when she's gone to New York. I think she's gone to Blue Hill.
Blue Hill, yeah.
But she also had an event a couple of falls ago at Blue Hill for the wives of the diplomats. Hmm. I think these were, I can't remember whether it was I think it must have been the UN diplomats. She took them up to, what's his name's place? The place up at in Pocantico. Blue Hill at Stone Barns.
Blue Hill and Stone Barns, yep, Blue Hill.
Yeah. She took them up there, and they made, I was able to taste the food because I was covering that, and boy, oh boy, that was really special. She's hit, yeah, most of the right places. I'm not watching it so carefully anymore because I'm not doing it. So I'm not looking around for stuff the way I had to before. But I'm not sure she's gone to the Inn at Little Washington yet.
Mm-hmm.
I may be wrong, but if she hasn't made that, now, of course, that isn't right in Washington. It's an hour and a half out of Washington, but it's considered our best restaurant on every level in this area.
Hmm.
So, but I may be wrong. You might have to go look that up and see whether she has been there. Not aware that she had.
Well,
and I certainly was out there. I was there myself in December, and, you know, pictures usually go up when somebody like that has come, and I didn't see one.
Well, I know you. Are you ever going to write a book about this unique position of having covered some aspect of food for all this presidents since LBJ all the way up to Laura Bush? I mean, I know you've written 9 books, the newly released 20-minute menus, which I want to ask you about briefly in a second, but you've written Summertime Cookbook, Pure and Simple, Elegant but Easy, Freeze with Ease, that was in 1967, Comfort Cocktails, Stay for Supper, Keep It Simple, You've Got It Made, and The Best of Degustibus. So are you working on a new book, and would you ever cover this? No, you're done.
No. There are lots of people who write about presidents and first ladies, and I'm leaving the field to them.
Uh-huh.
And they can use whatever material they find that I've written about. What you just mentioned, books and recently released, no, there are no recently released books. The last book I did was Cooking for Comfort, and that was sometime after 9/11 that I wrote that one. The book that is probably the most popular, and it was re-released and redone, was Elegant but Easy. That was the first book I ever wrote, and I rewrote it, or you know, got rid of a lot of recipes and put a lot of new recipes in it. Much more recently, and I use some of my books all the time, and I use that book more than anything else.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, all of these presidential coverages, all your work for the New York Times and Washington Post, and you won an Emmy for the for your consumer reporting for the NBC affiliate WRC TV. I mean, all of that pales in comparison, of course, to the turkey article you wrote on November 21st, 2001. And you wrote, one of my favorite line is, you were talking about heritage turkeys and how they're endangered and how, you know, basically all the turkeys consumed in the U.S. each year comes from one breed, but you wrote, there is a movement afoot. And, of course, that movement was, at the time, being run, you know, by me and some of my team. And that was a very amazing opportunity you provided for us because you essentially laid the foundation, although you will probably not admit it, but you laid the foundation for the heritage movement in the United States. So tell us about that. What do you remember? And that was a real seminal. It was basically the heirloom equivalent, but from proteins. So tell us about what you remember of that article in 2001.
I do not remember how I learned about the turkeys. But I determined to go, because I've always thought turkey was the most boring thing that you could possibly serve. And I remember my children at Thanksgiving complaining year after year, oh, turkey, it's that. So one year I served them brisket. Then they really complained. You know, you got to have turkey. So however I heard about heritage turkeys, I was already aware of other things that you had done. I wanted to know more about them because I thought, is it possible, after having tried organic turkey and wild turkey, that there is something that would really taste like turkey, used to taste when I was a child? And we did a taste test. I wrote about the year before would anybody be able to buy them, because I wrote about it at around Thanksgiving. And we got there were four breeds, I think, that I tried, and we took them to a New York University kitchens of where they taught classes, and we cooked all the turkeys. And I think that's what we did. I don't remember. It's not important. And I taste tested them all and came to the conclusion that the bourbon red, that's right, that's how you call it, right?
Correct.
Okay. That had, while they were all nice, the bourbon red was really flavorful. Mm-hmm. And from that day on, that's what we have for Thanksgiving. I got to tell you, for the size of my family, there's a lot of turkey left over. But it's worth it, and it's worth the price, because the turkey is so delicious.
Well, you know, we always like to say to the best way to help a family farmer is to buy from him or her.
Yep.
And that article really set the foundation for Americans, you know, to directly support farmers with their wallets and to pay for, you know, non-commodity alternatives. And, you know, Frank Reese was the first guy, you know, yep, to be known. But I think there's probably 200-300 farms around the United States now who raise these rare
genetics. Oh, that many. Isn't that wonderful?
Yes. I mean, you know, how pure the genetics are, you know, is really an academic issue. I mean, the real thing is people understand that not all meat is created equal, and in large part thanks to that article. And what you said about the unhealthy animals needing antibiotics is partially because they're all confined into a small space, but also because they are already doomed to a life, a little bit of pain because of these scurrilous genetics that make them grow so fast. But of course, their respiratory, skeletal, and cardiovascular systems can't keep up with that fast growth. So good, strong genetics are a very important foundation for a healthy, happy animal, and you really set the foundation for that. So thank you on behalf of all the heritage farmers out there through our network and through others for that very important piece. And looking to the future, Marion, I want to just, you know, in conclusion, talk about the future, especially your work on the board of directors of Sterling College in Vermont.
Well, it seems to me that all the things I did all my working life that had to do with food have all coalesced and congealed into my being on the board of trustees of a very small college in Craftsbury Common, Vermont, in the Northeast Kingdom, called Sterling College. And it is a college that offers a bachelor's degree, accredited. It's a working college. And two of its most important bachelor's degrees are in sustainable agriculture and sustainable food systems. And so I've been able to be helpful to them because of my background. Not because I raise money, because I don't even know how to raise money. You know, you don't work for the New York Times or any other newspaper. You don't go around raising money. Mm-hmm. Of course, nobody asks you for any either. Mm-hmm. You can't get any from the kinds of salaries you get. And I've been working with them for several years now, and they have a brand new president, not brand new, a year and a half now, who is just dynamite, growing, and it's already enlarged the size of the college student body from a mere 100 to 120 in the first year, and is going ahead with these programs. They raise a lot of their own food, and animals as well as fruits and vegetables. I suppose more than fruits, really. It's a college that anybody who cares anything about sustainable agriculture should know more about. And they're very involved with the a core of the in the area. It's called the town is called Hardwick, the biggest town in the area, that is now known as the center, the town that was saved by food. And it has several very well-known young people who farm up there and have done such a brilliant job that, for example, one of them called Jasper Hill, the cheese people, won the best in show at the American Artisanal Cheese Festival meeting this year. That's the cheese's Winnemere, by the way, for anyone who wants to run out and buy it because it's winter cheese.
I have some in my fridge right now.
Oh, you're lucky.
Yeah, it's delicious.
And there's High Mowing Organic Seed Company, where most of the seeds for the White House garden come from. Yeah. Tom Stearns has that. And there's Pete's Greens, who's known for his incredible CSAs. He has 600-person CSAs and raises lots of stuff under hoop houses because it's freezing up there all the time in the winter, really freezing, or below freezing. And another fellow who is doing a lot of stuff with soybeans and yogurt products. And they are part of the core, and they all work together now with Sterling, and it's worth seeing. And it's a, by the way, it's a beautiful part of the world.
Well,
gorgeous.
We're going to be
in there, so you know that already.
Yeah, no, Vermont is really unlike any other state, and you know, made in Vermont is a statement of with a real. Means something. Made in Vermont. I mean, everything about that state. The Jasper Hill people have carved out, you know, caves in the mountains to age cheeses for the cheesemakers. Even the way the laws are on the, with the highways, there's no billboard policy.
Right.
And then
right.
They only have those two major highways that go north-south. So it's not so easy to just drive 100 miles throughout past the state and not visit any of the slow-inspired businesses, the mom-and-pop joints, the family joints. So, yes, we're big fans of all things Vermont, and we're going to be personally visiting Sterling, and we're also going to be, more importantly, covering Sterling College, thanks to Marion's recommendations on the network. So stay tuned throughout 2014 for occasional stories on that great organization out there. And Marion, thank you so much for spending an hour with us, and this is hopefully the first of many visits of you on the network. And you know, we're big fans of what you've meant to food over the past few decades, and hope that you continue to be a force for decades to come.
Well, thank you very much, and I've had a ball talking to you, and sometime I'll even discover some of the things you want to know the answers to that I can't find among my papers.
Well, you have open mic here. It'll be like Elijah's mic, but it'll be for Marion Burrow. So thank you very much,
thanks.
And we will talk to you soon. And thanks for listening. You've been listening to The Main Course, and we will be back next week with a new episode. And stay tuned for Arts and Seizures, which will air in a few minutes.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.